I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hi, Jordan. And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. Do you want to say it twice as well?
Hello.
Hello, hello. Hello.
I like to be my own echo sometimes.
I like that. It's like a sound check. 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, so this week, we're going to take a look at the greatest movies of Total Film's lifetime, because our current issue is our 300th. We're 300 issues old. It's in the shops right now with the lovely Wonder Woman on the cover. So do take a look at that. We started back in 1997. We were barely born by then, were we? So which 10 films have made the cut of the best of the intervening decades? So we'll start our countdown in a minute. But first, shall we have a quick look at this week's releases? Jordan, what have you been having a look at for this week's viewing pleasure?
I've been watching Clemency, which is writer-director Chinoye Chukwu's Death Row drama. Alfre Woodard stars as Bernadine Williams. She's the governor of a prison that holds death row inmates. And the clemency of the title refers to the fact that as governor, she has the authority to grant a stay of execution at any time before the inmate is executed. So in a very real sense, she holds the lives of these men in her hands. It opens with this sort of stomach-churningly horrible sequence of an execution by lethal injection that goes wrong. And Bernadine, she's someone who stoically saw her job as ending the lives of these men with as much professionalism and dignity as possible. But gradually she starts to see the horror and barbarity of the things that she has to do on a daily basis, particularly as she gets closer to the inmate who's due for execution next, Anthony Woods, played by Aldis Hodge, who you may recognise from The Invisible Man, which he was in earlier this year. He's a man who sort of maintains his innocence over a decade after being convicted of shooting a police officer. So it's a pretty intense, harrowing character study, extremely sparse and claustrophobic, because outside, you know, the concrete confines of the prison, Bernadine's life revolves around drinking, getting horribly drunk every night, basically curing her pains with the bottom of a glass, and a relationship with her loving husband where emotionally, she's just 100% absent from the relationship. So it's powerful stuff, and Alfre Woodard is pretty stunning here, I have to say. It's one of those performances where her face and her physicality just tells you everything you need to know. And unlike something like Dead Man Walking or The Green Mile, the film itself is sort of devoid of sentimentality or histrionics. It's a sort of chillingly plausible depiction of the horrors of death row. All I'll say about it is I have a pretty high tolerance for challenging and tough filmmaking, but more than anything, this film just made me feel really bad. If you agree that the death penalty is a barbaric thing to still have in 2020, then this isn't going to enlighten you beyond what you already know and believe. But it is very much worth watching if you're in the right mind frame and you feel like you can stomach something this tough going.
Presumably you need a box of tissues as well.
Yeah. It's emotional stuff.
Yeah, you're going to be weeping your way through this. And also, like, there was sort of discussion that Alfre Woodard had been sort of dissed on the sort of awards circuit, because this came out, you know, in that awards corridor, but she didn't get a nom. Do you think she should have done?
Yeah, based on the strength of her performance alone, definitely. It actually premiered at Sundance last year, so it's 18 months since it premiered. It's taken a while to come out in the UK, but for me, the wait has definitely been worth it. And like I say, if you're in the mood for it, it's really powerful stuff. And Alfre Woodard gives probably the best performance I've ever seen her give.
Wow, I want to see that. So where can people see that and when?
That's on VOD and in cinemas that are actually open from Friday. And the distributor, Bohemia, is actually splitting revenue from this film with independent cinemas across the UK. So it's very much worth trying to see in a cinema if you can, if you feel ready for that.
Yeah, you're doing some good as well as making yourself feel bad. Matthew, have you got something? Yeah, have you got something slightly lighter, or is yours also needing a box of tissues?
Well, mine is kind of light and dark at the same time. So
What have you been watching? Bad Education.
Bad Education. It's not to be confused with the Almodovar film or the Jack Whitehall comedy. however, it's set in a school. It's based on a true life case. And I kind of feel I shouldn't maybe say too much about this if you don't know the facts of the case, because this is one of those films where it's best to go in cold. But suffice to say, it is to do with a massive public school scandal that occurred in the noughties. And this is a dramatisation. It's directed by Corey Finley, who did Thoroughbreds, which was another dark comedy. And this too is a dark comedy. And it stars Hugh Jackman as a superintendent of a group of schools and Alison Janney as his assistant. And I feel like I shouldn't really say too much more than that, because I went in completely cold to this film and it was full of surprises, things I didn't expect. But there is some very bad behaviour by some people, and it kind of snowballs and escalates, and you kind of sit there thinking this is one of those stranger than fiction type stories.
Yeah.
But it is very funny at the same time. Hugh Jackman's terrific. Alison Janney's terrific as usual. And there are quite a few twists and turns, but it's also quite sobering as well. A spoiler to say, but there's a caption at the end that's kind of jaw-dropping.
That's very enticing, Matthew Leyland. You've told me so little that I actually know.
I've told you nothing.
To see the end title. So when is Bad Education out?
It's out right now. It's on Sky Cinema or Now TV. It's an HBO production. But yes, in the UK, you can watch it on Now TV.
Perfect. Okay.
I thoroughly recommend it.
Well, I'm going to throw into the mix my choice for this week, which is St. Francis. I don't know if either of you have seen it, but it's a little gem. And obviously, it's one of those films that, you know, if you've been seeing I May Destroy You, have you watched any of that, the Michaela Cole?
I haven't yet, no.
Yeah, not yet, but I hear great things.
So that's got a lot of column inches for depicting period sex. And St. Francis starts out with period sex and a discussion of gentlemen who enjoy that practice being called bloodhounds. So I learned something immediately. But basically, it's written by Kelly O'Sullivan, and she stars in it as Bridget, who is this 34-year-old woman who is serving tables, feels like she hasn't really achieved anything with her life, and goes to a job interview to be a nanny for the summer for this little girl of a same-sex couple, who one is about to have a baby and the other is working extremely hard. So the parents are not really available to this little girl, Frances. And she probably is like the least likely person to get this job. She has an abortion just before she starts the job, which plays into this whole sort of idea of what parenting is and the roles of women in life, from provider to parent to nanny to friend to sister. And it's basically just this very gentle story of this summer that she has with this tiny girl who's an absolute delight. But the thing that's arresting about it, like I May Destroy You, is that it's very pedestrian in its discussion and showing of what happens to women and women's bodies, in as much as when she does the abortion, you see the accoutrements of that, you see the pad, the vomiting. It's not a drama. There's a very supportive partner involved. She does bleed on chairs occasionally. There's the whole thing about a woman who's just had a baby and a discussion of postnatal depression and breastfeeding in public and people's disgust at that. And so there's a lot of issues about women in this, but that makes it sound like it's a sort of hit you over the head with it kind of drama. Yeah. But actually, it's just really lovely. The little girl says at one point, "I feel seen." And that's a sort of cliched sort of phrase at the moment. But watching it, I feel seen. I feel like this is a real depiction of things that women go through in all stages of their life, done with a really light touch and comedy and pathos, and I loved it. So that is my little gem for this week. It reminded me of Tully. It's not anywhere near as sort of dark as that, but the ideas that are there, and it's also quite empowering as well to watch. So that is my recommendation, and that is out this Friday on all platforms on VOD. So I suggest you have a look at it. It's 1 hour 40, which is another little delight. I love that all of these films that are coming out in lockdown are all a decent length and not 3 hour long epics. You can actually watch those in between frantically typing at your kitchen desk or whatever else you're doing. So those are our three films for this week.
Three for three recommendations.
Three for three. They're all good. There's no
weak links.
Goob this week. Shall we get on then and look at our top 10 movies of our lifetime? Let's start at number 10 with this.
I want you to hit me as hard as you can.
Why? How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight?
Okay, so this is Fight Club, obviously, which came out in 1999. What's that about then, Matthew, for those that don't know what this film is about? Obviously, it's about a fight club, but how?
Well, yeah, this is David Fincher's film from 1999 with Brad Pitt and Edward Norton. Brad Pitt plays Tyler Durden, who befriends Edward Norton's character, and they start up an underground fight club. Obviously, I'm not going to say anything about it because the first rule of Fight Club is
you don't talk about Fight Club.
Yes.
But and the second rule.
But there are lots of men punching each other in the face and so on. There's a big metaphysical twist towards the end, and it's probably Fincher's, I'd say, most socially critical film in a way. Kind of a big dig at the consumer society and very anarchic all these years on. And it's kind of good to see that it made it into the top 10 because it's always been a big TF favourite. We've always championed it right from the start with countless features and interviews on it over the years. So, yeah, it's good to see. I mean, I think a number of other Fincher films did make it into the countdown, but this one was far and away the highest voted. That's very much in keeping with the TF ethos over the years.
And, you know, it has this amazing performance. You know, Edward Norton, you know, he has done some amazing films and some not so amazing films, but this is just one of the ones where he's just amazing. Really, really opaque, as it turns out. And also Brad Pitt. I mean, I don't think we'd really seen Brad Pitt like this before we saw this film, did we?
Not quite. That sort of god of mischief almost, just ultra cool. But you know that there's something wrong with him innately because his our view on society is so twisted and nihilistic. He's an exceptional character, and then the twist just makes it perfect, how it all slots together by the end. Yeah, it's a special bit of filmmaking, a bit of writing.
And speaking of people who we haven't seen like this, Helena Bonham Carter in this, we've been used to seeing her in corsets, and then she's sort of this
an ivory era.
Yeah, and then here she is sort of barreling around with these two guys and, you know, a hot mess and American accent and kind of unrecognisable from those sort of merchant ivory roles.
And Meatloaf as well. I think it's Meatloaf.
I mean, who can forget Meatloaf? So why do you think this one has stood the test of time from 1997 to now? Why is this Fincher the one that has particularly stood head and shoulders above the others?
I suppose it's kind of it's continued its relevance, really. I mean, it was incredibly provocative at the time. I seem to remember there were a lot of like newspaper critics were quite up in arms about it. I seem to remember it was quite controversial. And perhaps it isn't so much these days, but it is still a very provocative, relevant film.
Yeah, and you kind of get the full barrage.
And the style of it as well. I mean, Fincher, he kind of unleashes all his tricks. That's aged really well. You know, he's kind of his tricksy edits and his camera moves. And then, of course, there's the big twist as well. I mean, that's still held up as one. I think one of the best twists of recent years.
Don't know that twist?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to say it, but surely they
obviously don't say it.
There's probably someone out there who hasn't seen it yet and somehow avoided it.
It's the same person that hasn't seen The Sixth Sense probably as well.
Yeah, but it has been like a much imitated twist as well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. I think we've seen it quite a lot since then of this particular twist. And so now you kind of second guess that in some films. Oh, is that what's happening? Whereas I feel like when Fight Club came out, we were all blindsided by it. We were like, what? Yeah. Need to see it immediately, buy his ticket, go straight back in.
That's so skillfully, isn't it?
It was funny going back and reading reviews from the time for this. I was surprised how many people thought that, you know, the twist was cliched and that the ending was cheesy and things like this. I was expecting there to be, you know, unanimous praise from the time, but it feels like possibly it's one whose acclaim has grown and grown over the years rather than it was met with immediate lavish praise.
When I was interviewing Edward Norton, he recalled that Fight Club was one that they showed in Cannes, I believe. And when the film finished, there was sort of like just a silence. And he turned to Brad Pitt and was like, okay, kind of thing. And yeah, the immediate reaction wasn't one of love. It was one of what? And also, meh. And he really felt that Fight Club was one of his films, along with other films in his sort of CV, that has found an audience and gained with each year. respect and love. But he very much felt that Fight Club was one that at the time when it came out was not universally loved at all.
Yeah. As a controversial film compared to something like, say, Natural Born Killers, it's kind of aged quite well. So a lot of the times those films are really provocative at the time and cause huge amount of consternation. Then you kind of look back and you think, what was the fuss about? But with this, it's obviously does have some depth and still some resonance that have carried over down the years.
Okay, so that is a ever-growing cult classic. Shall we move on and see what topped that at number 9? Let's move on to this unsettling beauty, which is Sinking Into the Black at number 9.
Come to me.
Okay, so that is Under the Skin. Jordan, you love this sort of film. Come on, what is this about?
You say I love this, but this film is actually the subject of one of my biggest regrets as a professional journalist, because I reviewed this film and gave it 4 stars back in the day,
right,
when it's so obviously a 5-star film. And I don't know what I was thinking at the time. But I don't know,
because this is everything you love.
I know. I would like to atone for that.
You were just being churlish. A young, churlish buck.
I think I was just so overwhelmed by it, because it is just a total sensorial experience. You're just assaulted with sound and crazy imagery, and it's not a plot-heavy kind of film. So it stars Scarlett Johansson. This is Jonathan Glazer directing, previously of Sexy Beast. Scarlett Johansson plays an unnamed woman who we believe is an alien. She arrives on Earth, and basically the entirety of the film is her sort of seducing lonely men from a white van, driving around Scotland, luring them back to her strange alien lair, which is this impenetrable black otherworldly space, and seemingly dissolving them and devouring them, something along those lines. That's basically it.
She makes them into like alien pork pies for herself, doesn't she? She sucks all the meat out of them. And then moves on to the next
Alien
one.
Eleven seasons.
Yeah, and it's got this soundtrack that is so like intense and not particularly melodic.
Mika Levi.
Yeah. So the whole thing of it is very sort of jarring, and yet you can't stop thinking about it once you've watched it. Very slow paced. I mean, and also just not remotely glamorous, is it? It's Scotland in the winter, so it's raining. It's grey. She's got a black wig, so she's really toning down that Johansson blonde bombshell sort of image. She's got an English accent. She's wearing weird random clothes that she's stolen from New Look or wherever she goes in that shopping mall, and driving a white van. None of this is glamour. This is so far removed from the sort of Scarlett Johansson we've seen before, and yet absolutely fascinating because of that whole idea as well that they did it as a sort of fly on the wall. So she literally drove that van around with secret cameras in it. She did pick up people. And if she did pick up a random stranger on the side of the road, then they just got them to sign a waiver so that they would be in the film. So this sort of weird guerrilla filmmaking is just so hypnotic, isn't it?
I don't know how they did that, even back then with Scarlett Johansson, because she was incredibly famous even when they were in the film. How would you not recognise her?
Yeah, but if you were walking down a street near Glasgow and a lady in a black wig pulled over with an English accent and just said, oh, can you give me directions to the M1 or whatever, would you think, well, that must be Scarlett Johansson? You wouldn't, would you?
I guess not.
You would not even think that she would be.
Unlikely, I suppose.
Yeah. Unless that's what she does on her holidays. She might be right now enjoying a week of white van driving around in the Highlands. I mean, there's some pretty arresting imagery and scenes in this. What are your favourites?
That black room that she lures people into, this kind of interdimensional space where she does the skinning. I think they borrowed in Stranger Things. They totally
borrowed in quote marks.
I mean it's obviously quite a low budget film, but they make such brilliant use of the special effects to create these kind of eerie otherworldly sights and sounds. That's the real kind of genius of it.
And I love the fact that with that black room, it's actually a physical effect. It's not CGI. A room that had a black glass floor and had a sort of lever that as the person walked down the slope. It filled with black sort of viscous fluid.
Mm.
It's so weird, isn't it? The whole thing.
Yeah.
And then they're sort of suspended really in this black space until they pop and everything disappears out of them. And they're just like a sort of condom of a person. it's horrible. But the other scene, I think, that for me that's really horrible is more of an emotional horror, in as much as she goes to this beach and she sees this tragedy happen to this family. And one of the family members is this tiny baby that is left there. And if somebody doesn't intervene, that child will die. But because she's an alien and has no real empathy or emotional attachment to the human race, she's unmoved. And that in itself is quite as horrific an idea of someone leaving a child on a beach to die as popping people like sausages in a black room.
It's very unsettling.
So I think it really plays with a lot of emotional, psychological and physical horrors without being a splatterfest or an out-and-out shockfest. It's just very disquieting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we think this has gone above Fight Club because of its sort of daring and dexterity and pure filmmaking skill?
Yeah, I think so. And it just stays with you. I mean, it just sticks in your head so much. It's just so hard to shift. I mean, even if you didn't like it, it's just such an unforgettable film.
Yeah.
Either way.
And no one had really done anything like that before.
No.
Or I would argue since, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible to think that was only Jonathan Glazer's third film. And we haven't seen him since either. But I mean, every time he pops up, he gives us something pretty special with that and Birth and Sexy Beast. So I think this is his masterpiece.
So that is Under the Skin, which was 2013 at number 9. Shall we see what's at number 8?
I have this condition.
A condition?
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No. It's different from that.
What?
Since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades. If we talk for too long, I'll forget how we started. Next time I see you, I'm not going to remember this conversation.
This is Memento from 2000, Christopher Nolan's film, which is all as usual, not what it seems for a Nolan film. It's all out of order. You've got to put the pieces together. Matthew, what is this about?
This is Christopher Nolan's second film, following from 1998. But for most people, this is the moment he arrived. This is his breakout. It was based on a pitch by his brother, Jonathan Nolan, of Westworld fame. And it centres on Guy Pearce's Leonard, who has short-term memory syndrome, and he's hunting for his wife's killer. But he can only remember things in 15-minute bursts, so hence he tattoos his body with clues. And we follow him across the course of the film looking for his wife's killer. But obviously, the big trick is that the film takes place in reverse chronology. So we see what happened the 15 minutes before, and then before that, and gradually rewinding. And then we learn more about the truth of the case up to the climax.
You can't watch this drunk, can you? You've got to be on your toes when you're watching Memento. And again, it's
the first time I saw it.
It's another one that is one of those classic. As soon as it's finished, you want to watch it again, knowing what you know at the end to know at the beginning. People have copied it since, thinking about The Machinist and things like that. But this was sort of the first time we'd really seen anything as sort of clockwork as this classic Nolan clockwork filmmaking. Why was it so impressive, Jordan?
Well, in terms of Nolan's career, for me, it's really his calling card film. It establishes his fascination and his just incredible ability to do amazing things with chronology and time. It's something that's continued throughout his career. But the thing that really impresses me about Memento, even to this day, is just how precise it is and just how well engineered it is. From a scriptwriting perspective, it's totally bulletproof. There's nothing about it that feels out of place or extraneous, or everything needs to be there and everything that's there serves a purpose. And just the fact that it fits into this thriller story where you want to know what happened to this person, and the fact that your lack of knowledge about what happened perfectly mirrors Leonard's lack of knowledge about what happens in his own life because of his short-term memory loss. It's just a perfect marriage of form and storytelling where it really puts you in the headspace of this character.
Yeah, I don't know any more than he knows, so I'm completely at a loss as well. It does make your brain hurt watching it. But that's really good as well. I mean, that's the other thing about Nolan's films that I like, is it's not easy. He makes you work for it. And I like to be challenged when I go to the cinema, and Memento does that.
Yeah, it's a rewarding watching experience. Although, do you remember back in the day, there was a DVD release where they released a chronological cut of it as like a bonus feature?
Like, why?
A, what's the point? And B, I can't believe Christopher Nolan let them do that. Like, can you imagine
he
letting them do that now?
Would he? I was going to ask, has anybody actually watched that?
I feel like I must have done, just because I love Memento so much.
But I don't know why you would, because the joy of it is seeing it backwards. Backwards and is the right way.
It must just seem weird as well. It must just look really disordered, even though it's going in the right direction this time.
Yeah.
It must surely mess up the tidiness of the screenplay.
Let us know. Anyone out there who's seen it, let us know. Is it a better version to watch it the right way around? Okay, so that's Memento from 2000. Shall we see what just pipped it to the post at number 7? It's this, and it's time to put on your tap shoes, boys.
Strange that we keep running into each other.
Maybe it means something.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so. You could just write your own roles, you know, write something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you gonna do?
I have my own club.
So that's La La Land, Damien Chazelle's 2016 film that obviously had the big upset at the Oscars and was beloved by critics when it came out. Why? What is it about this film that people so enjoyed, given that it's actually pretty hard sell? It's a musical in 2016. Was anyone crying out for this? But maybe it's the film that we didn't know we needed.
Yeah, I think it absolutely was. And the thing that sticks in the memory for me is the music itself, of course. But on every level, I found this film completely wonderful. So it's written and directed by Damien Chazelle, his second film after Whiplash. Another masterpiece. It stars Ryan Gosling as a jazz pianist and Emma Stone as this aspiring actress. And it's about how their lives intersect and their sort of burgeoning romance in LA. And there's not a whole lot more to it than that, but it isn't a traditional romantic comedy in the sense that all their problems are worked out and their lives turn out great. There's a kind of dark undercurrent to the whole thing, which is, I think, is really what helped separate it from the crowd at the time, as well as its astonishing music and dance numbers and its incredible visuals.
You know, you mentioned those dance numbers. These are big, old school, huge cast people doing numbers on the freeway off ramp, which he really did, and making use of all those amazing LA locations. It's really sort of magical in that sort of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers way, but at the same time, incredibly modern, and the sort of issues that the two have feel very pertinent, the sort of push-pull of romance and ambition, and if you love someone enough to let them pursue their dreams that might not involve you, and is that the greater sort of sacrifice? And also, you know, not to give things away, but it had that incredible ending that was just a gut punch for audiences, that you thought you were going down one route and then you got this sort of slice of an alternative reality that just gave you this such sort of nostalgia and sadness to end on, that was just lovely and heartbreaking in the best way.
I agree completely. That ending is still stuck with me to this day. I remember sitting in the cinema and watching that for the first time and just feeling like the earth was opening up beneath me. I was just so heartbroken for those characters, but it is an absolutely beautiful way to end the film. And that,
and you wouldn't want it any other way, would you?
Exactly, yeah. You don't want the cookie cutter happy Hollywood ending. Like, that's what makes that film really special, is that it doesn't just take the easy road.
Obviously, the other thing that La La Land is very famous for, not only its music, its numbers, its beautiful ending, is that snafu at the Oscars. Should it have won Best Picture?
Envelope game.
It thought it had for 3 seconds, and then it hadn't. Should it have?
I'd say I preferred Moonlight. I mean, I felt utterly gutted for Damien Chazelle, because that must have been the worst moment of his life. But I did prefer Moonlight, so I was quite pleased that it did win.
Yeah, I was team La La Land on the night, even though I think Moonlight is an extraordinary film. But La La Land, you know, Chazelle got Best Director, Emma Stone won Best Actress, so it's not like it was snubbed completely.
No, it didn't go home empty-handed. But yeah, I mean, I can't think of a worse scenario for a filmmaker to think they've won an Oscar. And then literally seconds later to realize they haven't.
And they were very gracious about it, weren't they?
They were.
Very fitting for a film about dreams being shattered at the 11th
hour. And endings. You thought it was one ending. Like, guess what? La La Land. I mean, he couldn't have written that, could he?
Pure La La Land. Glad to have
purely him. Selfish point of view, it did make watching the Oscars much more amusing and interesting than it had been in previous years, because we hadn't really seen drama like that. The Oscars had got to such a stage where it was, oh yeah, and now they come up and get their prize and they get theirs. So for that to happen, it was genuinely exciting.
It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Jordan and I were watching it together and we could not believe what was happening. It really did put a little boost into proceedings. But anyway, from Damien Chazelle's sadness at the Oscars, shall we move on to another golden thing that someone really, really wants? It's time to get to number six.
This is the One Ring, forged by the Dark Lord Sauron. Sauron needs only this ring to cover all the lands of a second darkness. He's seeking it. Seeking it all. His thought is bent on it.
Okay, so this is The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And as you boys know, I can't stand The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So come on. You are going to have to talk about this because for me, I just, no. So go on then. Why is this one so high? I mean, really, why is it so high?
I don't know really, because I think probably split the vote a bit. I think people have different favourites. I mean, I kind of like them all equally, I have to say. I really couldn't pick a favourite out of the three. But I think a lot of people prefer this one because there's a bit more character building, because it's kind of got that slow burn, introduces the characters, it doesn't rush into action. You get to know the characters as well and you go on this big journey with them. I know that Viggo Mortensen, who plays Aragorn, he said that the sequels, he felt they were leaning a lot more towards special effects and big action set pieces. So I think he prefers this one, and I think a few people feel the same. Although, of course, you do get a lot of huge set pieces and plenty of action as well. Perhaps this one does have slightly more heart, certainly in the characterization department.
I pretty much agree with Matthew. There's not a lot in it between all three of them for me. I think they're all pretty much perfect. But Fellowship does edge it for me because it was just so magical watching it in the cinema for the first time. I hadn't actually read the books before I saw the film, and I was just overwhelmed by how perfectly everything worked. Just looks incredible. It's truly transporting. Howard Shore's music is just remarkable and is something that still gets heavy rotation on my iPhone pretty much every day. It's just a remarkable story of heroism and brotherhood and all that incredible stuff that Tolkien sort of pioneered in his writing. It's really pretty much a perfect film for me.
High praise.
He's got Sean Bean in it.
Who, frankly, you must have known he was going to die.
Sean Bean.
I think at the time, I was naive enough that I didn't realise that he basically died in every role he was in.
Yeah.
So his death, Boromir's death, is still one of the most heartbreaking things I ever see on screen. Yeah. It makes me well up every time I see it.
Yeah, it's very poignant, isn't it? Probably the most poignant death in the whole series.
Tell me what your favourite scenes are in this. I mean, what are the sort of barnstorming scenes that make it this just epic film?
The big standout is the Mines of Moria, I think.
Yeah.
That whole sequence from the troll attack to the orc chase and then the Gandalf-Balrog showdown. You shall not pass. It's just properly iconic stuff. Just gives me goosebumps just thinking about it. Arguably, other films in the trilogy have bigger set piece moments. I mean, it's hard to top Helm's Deep if you're going to pick a single action sequence from the entire trilogy. But as Matthew said, there's something about Fellowship's balance of character and action and just an introduction to this world that just hits all the right notes for me.
I think Jackson really got a handle on CGI as well. I mean, obviously there is a lot of CGI, but he kind of gives it, there's so much luster and weight to his effects, which, you know, we hadn't really seen in a lot of films. He handles it so well. I mean, it could have been an absolute green screen nightmare, but him and obviously the people at Weta, they really thought this through properly and gave the effects the weight they needed.
And you went around on set, didn't you, Matthew?
Well, yeah, I was on the set of the Hobbit. Yeah, it was quite a physical set. I mean, there was a lot of greenery. There was like a little lake in the middle of the studio. and lots of physical actors, but obviously a big sea of green screen as well. But it did feel quite earthy. You know, you could see all the mud on the boots of the actors and on their weapons and swords. Mm. So you can see, you know, it was very grounded as well, a very grounded spectacle.
Yeah, that's the thing about the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It was just before basically anything became possible with computers.
Mm.
So they had to do a lot of it practically. They had to create these giant miniatures, bigatures. And you can just feel the tactility on screen. Like, still surprises me to this day that no one's actually tried to do it in this way since. The result is just so much better.
Mm.
Like, you just look how beautifully those films have aged. I mean, there's very little in it which looks ropey to this day. And that's down to the perfect marriage of, you know, practical filmmaking and groundbreaking visual effects work.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that takes us to our number six. So we will reconvene next week to do the countdown from 5 to 1. And we'll find out what is the best of the best and what's beaten those amazing films to our number one. So right now, shall we just have time for a reader's question? What film do you want to see remade and who would you cast?
That's very tricky.
I'll go first because love The Sound of Music. It's lovely. But I've always felt that there's not enough sexual chemistry between the captain and Maria. And, you know, he's a handsome man.
Where's this going?
So I think we should have a remake of The Sound of Music, but with no music in it. And it's just about that nun turning up at that house and finding that hot captain and melting his heart. I think that's going to be something that would be quite nice to watch.
What would you call it, though, without music?
It would still be The Sound of Music because I'd still sort of do like the fact that they were doing singing and they went and they used that as the cover to get away from the Nazis, but just not as much singing. So it's not quite as twee and actually more like they've really got the hots for each other. I don't know what this says about me, but I think it's because as a kid growing up, I just thought Christopher Plummer in that outfit was just so attractive. Such a handsome man.
I don't think you're the only one.
And still to this day, you know, I'm like, yeah, I can understand you, Maria. Yeah, even with that many children, I'd be into it. So I think I cast Oscar Isaac as Captain Von Trapp. I think he'd look good in a captain's outfit. And for Maria, I'm going to say Carey Mulligan. And then, you know, I don't mind throwing Christoph Waltz in as a Nazi, because I feel like that was his best performance. And so I'm happy to see that again. So yeah, that's what I'm going for. Yeah, and also I think I'd probably like with this, you know, a throwback tune, you know, a pop tune that charts, that has a video with the two of them looking at each other and turning in slow motion to stare at each other across the lounge. So that's mine. Go.
I'm going to pick To Kill a Mockingbird, not because I think the original is bad in any way. I think it's a little bit simplistic, and if you remade it now, it could definitely be more nuanced and politically relevant. But the main reason I want to remake it is because I want to cast Tom Hanks as Atticus Finch. I just think he would be wonderful in that role.
Yeah, I can
and
see
I just
that.
Want to see that.
I think I'd go for Attack of the Clones because it's my least favourite of the Star Wars movies. Sorry, George. And I feel like someone like Dave Filoni, who did the Clone Wars TV series, he could do a much better job because he's proven himself in live action now with The Mandalorian. So I think he could tackle that one and just, you know, bring it up so it's more to the standard of the other movies and keep all the same actors, because I mean all those actors, they've been great in other things and bring in a few more practical effects. I think we wouldn't need much doing to it. That would make me happy, really.
You probably have to de-age a few people.
There is that.
Ewan could still play Obi-Wan, definitely.
Yeah,
because he is going to play Obi-Wan again.
You
might need to remove a few of Hayden Christensen's wrinkles if he's going to play young Padawan.
Yeah, but they can do that, can't they? Easy enough. Cut down and save budget on the other CGI and put it onto the de-aging. And then job done. I'll be happy with that.
Great. So if anybody wants to contact us for scripts for these, we're available. There's some great ideas here. All right. So there's just enough time to remind you that there is 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF when you go to checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. Okay, it's time to say goodbye. Please join us next week for our countdown from 5 to 1. But for now, should we say goodbye, boys?
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.